now hear People Against Lions, 09CA392.
May it please the court, counsel. Good afternoon. I'm Ingrid DeFranco, registration number 31206 for Mr. Lyons. For a misdemeanor case, this has a whole lot of really interesting issues. The first is, can you sustain the first prong of a Batson challenge based solely on surname? No. My name is DeFranco. I am Swedish and Irish. There was no prima facie showing by the prosecution because there's nothing in the record about anything but a surname. We don't know if it was marital. We have nothing about the juror's appearance.
So, Mr. Franco, didn't you agree or concede in your brief that the first point of the Batson challenge is effectively moot because the lawyer went on and gave a non-race-based reason for excluding the juror in question?
I don't believe I conceded that. That may be the fact. But what she did was to give a race-neutral explanation for seeking to strike this juror.
Right. And aren't there cases from our court or the Supreme Court that say when that race-neutral explanation is offered, then you automatically go past the first step to the second step?
Yes, I believe there are. Okay. But you still can't sustain it based solely on a surname.
Why not? I mean, if I have something against Italian surname, and you have an Italian surname, and I then decide that, well, I don't want anybody with Italian heritage on there, I may be guessing wrong about your heritage, but my purpose and my motive might still be improper.
That's correct, but we don't have any indication that that was the case here. We don't have any indication that this juror was Hispanic any more than reading a cold record you would have any indication that I was not.
But isn't the issue here whether the counsel's motive was an improper motive? That is, we've got a Hispanic victim here, and I think I want to get anybody off that jury who might sympathize, whether it is that she is herself Hispanic or whether she's married to a Hispanic man. I want her gone.
That certainly could be. That certainly, and that would be an improper motive.
Okay.
However,
and I'm sorry, Mr. Franco, while you're on the point, I mean, we could, or in this context, the court could look at the context or circumstantial evidence as well in deciding if a prima facie case was made. I suppose isn't that right question? Because here, for the context, as I understand it, was there's a Hispanic or a Hispanic victim. There were some, at least, evidence of racial, racist comments by your client, and the first two strikes are against people with Hispanic surnames. Isn't that enough just to get you a prima facie case?
No.
Okay, why not?
The first juror, Mr. De Herrera, expressed a bias for police officers in their credibility very clearly and probably should have been struck for cause, but wasn't. And then, in response to the district attorney's question regarding whether he could apply the law, if the law said you can't have two dogs, you can only have one, and I showed that he had two dogs, would you be able to convict? And he said, that's a trick question, and that was it. So had I been trying that case, I'd have kicked him off. I think that was an absolutely appropriate exercise of a peremptory, and there's no evidence to the contrary. So then we move on to the next one, and we don't know if it was happenstance or not. But her race-neutral reason was a well-accepted reason. And in fact, that young juror had said, or veneer person had said, when asked about contacts with the police, something to the effect of, yes, but they've always been fair, like all the time. Those were her exact words, like all the time. She was clearly young, she was 20. When defense counsel asked the jurors about bad neighbor interactions, she was silent, and there was quite a lot of back and forth with jurors, you know, wanting to express the awful run-ins that they'd had with neighbors, and she didn't have anything to say. So this was a young person who gave a kind of silly answer to the only question that she answered, and clearly didn't have the experience of having a horrible interaction with a neighbor. I mean, this was the Neighbors from Hell case. So that was a perfectly proper explanation for why she sought to exercise the peremptory. And then the trial court did something that's just incomprehensible. It said, well, there's nothing in her answers that would make her ineligible. And that's really what he said. And he applied the for cause standard to the Batson analysis, and that was just erroneous.
Well, I guess I would agree. I understand your point well. I think the, with all due respect to the trial judge here, it's hard for, on a cold record, to figure out what exactly the trial judge was thinking. And I suppose my question is going to is, help me with a standard here. You can read the trial judge's statement as you do. I think a reasonable person could do that. The judge denied the race-neutral explanation based on a challenge for, based on a cause standard. I think you can read it that way. I think you could also arguably read it to mean the court just wasn't persuaded with that race-neutral explanation, thought there's no, you know, I'm not buying it, and rejected it without much discussion, because the court does go on to say, I didn't hear anything, therefore I think it's an inappropriate, your rejection was inappropriate. So, you know, again, giving the court some benefit of the doubt, it seems like the court just didn't buy the race-neutral explanation as eloquently as you argue that it's valid. So what are we to do with that when you could read the explanation probably both ways?
Well, he didn't say what you would put into his mouth. He didn't say that.
He said it was an inappropriate purpose. He did say that the purpose of the challenge was inappropriate. And why can't we understand that to mean that it was an impermissible purpose?
Because because that turned for him on the fact that he hadn't heard anything that would make this potential juror ineligible. And that's all he tells us he's doing in terms of a legal standard. That's the legal standard that he announced when he rejected the use of the peremptory. So the next interesting question that I think this case poses for you is whether when a person builds a fence line on his property, his neighbor gets to take advantage of that. Because that's essentially what happened here. And I would like the court to recognize that there's no testimony in this case that the Ramirez property was fenced. The only testimony in this case is about this north-south fence line on the line where the Lyons and Ramirez property was contiguous. So if we don't have the premises fenced, we already have a problem with the trespass. Mrs. Ramirez testified under cross-examination that she owned part of the fence and the Lyons' owned part of the fence. She couldn't say which part she owned and they owned. She wasn't able to do that. She also admitted that the fence was buried in sand. So even if she had built the fence and she owned the fence, if by her own negligence she made that fence non-functional and invisible, then how is she entitled to claim that her land was fenced in a manner intended to give notice to a potential intruder that he was intruding?
So to the extent that she has these sheep enclosed in a fenced pen, and it is tied with a rope or whatever, and he unties that, isn't that some indication that it's a fenced area and she intends for that not to be intruded upon, and he is intruding upon it?
The corral,
yeah.
The animals were corralled. Certainly, had he gone in, there's no evidence that he entered the corral, none at all.
So to the extent that he let the sheep free, that's not a trespass, even by touching the fence and by opening the fence, you're saying that's not a trespass?
It isn't. He had to go onto the land. And what I said in my opening brief is, had the court found criminal mischief by destruction of what the defense characterized as a twine and the prosecution characterized as a rope, and there's no question that he cut that or in some way interfered with that, That could have been criminal mischief, but it's not a trespass if he didn't step in.
So you didn't enter or remain in or upon. Okay. Can I ask you, kind of relating to the same language, Mr. Franco, and maybe just I need clarification on the record. There seems to be, you and your colleague here are having a debate on, was there half offense? Was there some offense? Is it all buried? No offense at all? Because the statute, I mean, does it says, are enclosed in a manner to designed to exclude intruders or are fenced. And we read about the fence line, and I'm just really unclear on whether there was any fence at all.
It's not clear that there was. And the only other way I know to meet the statutory definition would be with a moat. And there's no evidence of a moat either. I mean, this is raw land.
Mr. Frank, I'm kind of puzzled by this whole argument about the fence, because from the briefs, my impression is that it's designed to give notice to the public that if I go on some property that belongs to you, that I would know either by the posting of a no trespassing sign or by the fence that it's your property. But here we're talking about Mr. Lyons having been a neighbor of Ms. Ramirez for years, so obviously he knew where his property ended and hers began.
Correct, but had she no fence and had never given him an instruction not to come onto her land, there's no trespass. Supreme Court tells us so. May I reserve the 4 minutes, please?
Yes.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Alice Hosley on behalf of the Attorney General's Office, number 32195. I want to apologize in the beginning. I'm a little under the weather today. I will do my best to keep my comments relevant. If you see me drifting off, please be free to bring me back. First thing I want to mention on the Batson issue, which is interesting, this reverse Batson context, I think, gives us a little room to play on what the real issues of Batson are. I think it's important to remember that peremptory challenges are not constitutional. They're strictly statutory. And it is never permissible to elect discriminatory intent when using a peremptory challenge. I think the issues of the cold record become irrelevant not only at the time that they give a race-neutral response, but at the time that the defense counsel says it has nothing to do with her nationality. I think at that point in time, he has responded to the prima facie case. And at this point, we do defer to the trial court who was in the room at the time. You know, there are not magic words that need to be made on the record. I think we can, from the record that is here, see that there was a discriminatory intent in excluding her. And I base that record on the voir dire of other similarly situated jurors. She was young, she was 20. There were two other jurors that sat that were 22 years old, one of which had expressed some neighbor dispute experience. The other one also remained silent when asked of the panel, does anybody here, I think the question was posed, does anybody here have or know of somebody who has had a situation similar to this case? There were some issues discussed about domestic violence, but really the counsel honed in, no, this is a neighbor dispute, and asked specifically the whole panel, only three of the entire panel, jurors 5, 11, and 13 responded that they had. That means 10 remained silent on the issue, one of which, again, was this 22-year-old who remained silent and his age similar, 20 and 22. I think it's hard to make a discrepancy between those, that at 22 you have a vast more life experience than you do at 20. So I think the age issue on the record compared to similarly situated jurors that had no response The question of whether they had explicit experience of neighbor disputes. And then the other is this, that she didn't have the correct, not the correct, but a significant experience, life experience to bring to a case like this. And I would point to the other jurors who, one was a replacement juror that responded, none that I couldn't say, I don't know. He was kept, regardless of his age. You know, these are two different brackets, age and experience.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I don't know that her not having a response to the question and her response to the question is, I don't know, an ambivalent response is really distinguishable.
I was just going to say, Ms. Hosley, I find it interesting that you're making this argument because when I started reading this, I was waiting to hear it, either in your brief or from the court. We see a lot of these cases, as you well know, you argue them. And you will frequently see, yeah, but you didn't, these people have all the same indicia. And the court didn't say that, which I found interesting. Now, I suppose that doesn't mean we can't look at the record ourselves, but let me take as, and I know you would disagree with this, so take this as a hypothetical. Say the court made it clear that the court is just relying on the wrong legal standard. Let's, again, I'm not putting it in your mouth because I expect you would disagree. But let's take Ms. DeFranco as right, that the court, you know, decided you didn't prove your non-racially motivated reason for a totally wrong legal reason. The court is applying the wrong legal analysis. Would we not have to reverse in that situation? That was a terrible question. Did you understand it?
Did I mention I wasn't feeling well?
I'm not either. That's probably why. But was that clear? I mean, it's a judge, you know, applying the wrong legal standard, and then from the wrong legal standard concludes, I don't think you proved a non-racially motivated reason. If the court applied the wrong legal standard, is that not grounds to reverse that?
Let me provide an answer, and if I'm not answering your question, maybe you can let me know. This is a context of Batson. I do take issue that the Batson procedure was not followed. I think very clearly, all on page 95 of the transcript. It's all in one nice concise page. There was a prima facie reason given. There was a race neutral reason given, and the court made a credibility determination as I read it. I understand what you're saying, but in a Batson procedure, when the objection is made and now it's raised on appeal, the question is, it's the third prong, the credibility determination, is a clear error standard. So I think it is, he was intending to make a Batson determination. I think that's clear from the record. So, it's to argue that he applied the wrong standard, I think on the review is for clear error. I think given the similarly situated jurors, given the fact that there were only two Hispanic surnamed jurors on the panel, and both were a peremptory challenge was used, one successfully, one unsuccessfully. And, you know, the nature of the case, the fact that the victim was going to have a Spanish interpreter at trial, was only going to be able to testify through an interpreter. I think all of these things playing show that there was not clear error for the court to make a credibility finding that defense attorney's race neutral reason just wasn't viable.
Ms. Hosley, the statute here under which Mr. Lyons was charged says that it's class 2 misdemeanor if the premises have been classified by the county attorney as agricultural land pursuant to a particular statute.
Yes.
And in this case, the prosecutor provided and the court accepted an instruction that omitted the words have been classified by the county assessor. How can this jury have made a decision based on this statute or as to a violation of this statute when phrasing in the statute was not instructed to them?
Your point is well taken. There was, you know, this issue of whether the land was designated by the county inspector never came up at trial. And I think that's what's important, is that this was not an issue. It was not in dispute.
Was there any, I'm sorry to interrupt you, this is a significant issue for me. Was there any evidence that the county assessor classified this land agricultural? I understood, you know, you made the argument, well, no one raised it, so it's okay in the jury instruction. My argument, I guess my question is going to sufficiency. Mm-hmm. Regardless of whether it was in the instruction or not, mm-hmm. I don't think there was a stipulation to county assessor. And doesn't there have to be evidence that the county assessor classified this property? And if so, what was it?
I think the evidence that the county had classified this land as agricultural goes in the trial came from the fact that the Department of Agriculture had declared the property in a state of emergency. The Weld County Board of Commissioners had issued an order. There were several hearings on this land and whether it had been overgrazed, whether animals could continue to graze there. The overarching, the significant evidence is that it wasn't in dispute because I think it.
But Ms. Hosley, I thought from the briefs that there had also been an order from the Department of Agriculture saying that livestock could no longer graze on that property until it was revegetated.
Yes, and that...
Doesn't that create a question of as to whether it was still agricultural land, assuming that what you just told us gave rise to an inference that it was agricultural land previously?
You mean that they... I'm sorry, that they couldn't graze on it anymore?
Right, because of the order that they couldn't graze on the land, isn't it possible that the land at a prior time was agricultural but was no longer agricultural at the time of the trial?
Well, I think that's where the trial court gave the jury a whole list of definitions. 2 pages as far as what agricultural land means.
But what agricultural land means when the county assessor is trying to decide whether to classify the land as agricultural. I mean, we might all agree that she was using it as agricultural, that she was prohibited from continuing to use it as agricultural. Where's the evidence that the county tax assessor says, okay, I'm going to tax this as agricultural land? Where's that evidence?
That evidence is not in the record as I read it, and I don't think because it wasn't in dispute at trial, the jury had sufficient evidence presented to them that this land was agricultural in use, and you know, based on all these other entities coming in and issuing orders. Again, the status of those orders and what they what teeth they really had and whether they could be really applied or not, and that, you know, all being outside of the issue. The issue is that the jury was instructed on agriculture. They had to find that it was agricultural land. It's not, they weren't given.
Did the defendant tender an instruction with regard to the elements?
The element was never an issue at trial. There was, as far as I understand, the instructions that were given by the defendant were on other issues.
According, if I remember correctly, Ms. Hosley, I thought Ms. DeFranco said in her brief that the trial counsel did tender an instruction on the second degree misdemeanor of trespass on land that actually tracked the statutory language, including the language referring to the county assessor, but that was rejected by the trial court. Is that consistent with your recollection?
To be honest, the jury instructions that were tendered that were rejected were on different issues, and I honestly don't remember. You have the record.
Okay, well, we can certainly check
on
that.
Yeah, I honestly don't remember whether that was rejected or not.
It was. So the answer is yes. But so coming back to what you just said, I don't think there's any question the jury had this lengthy instruction about what's agricultural land, but if there's no, and coming back, it's the first question Judge Carparelli asked you, if they had no instruction and not even asked to find that the assessor classified the land, and you yourself said that there's evidence not in the record as to that, how is this evidence sufficient? You're asking us to assume that that element of the statute was established.
No, I'm not asking you to assume. I'm asking you to find that it wasn't plain error. Because it wasn't at issue at trial, and because it never, whether or not the land was agricultural, whether this they admitted, you know, whose instruction they chose to admit, to the jury. I'm not arguing that it was presented and that they, I'm just saying that it's not plain error in order for it not to have when it wasn't an issue and it wasn't presented.
And I'm sorry, I keep interrupting you, I apologize. I guess my question to you is, I'm not quite sure you're saying what isn't plain error. It sounds like you're saying the instruction, perhaps error is not plain. But do we just ignore the fact that there was no evidence of an element of the offense? How is that not plain error?
And I think that has been decided. Omission of an instruction, if it's not an issue at trial, is not plain error.
What about omission of an element of the offense as a matter of substantive evidence?
Supposedly, I think the distinction here is it's one thing to say that the trial court erred when it permitted the instruction. It's another thing to say that the record of testimony is insufficient to prove a violation of the statute. And I think the question to you is, how do we deal with that? If there is no evidence here that this land was classified by the county assessor, or is there evidence that it was so classified by the county assessor?
I think that the evidence that it was agricultural land was presented to the jury. There was sufficient evidence for them to determine that it was agricultural land. The issue about from the county assessor, admittedly, that was not, it was not an issue. It was not presented, and it wasn't an issue. However, the statute, I think it's important to point out that it's a class 2 misdemeanor. The difference is on agricultural land, not agricultural land, is the difference between a class 2 and a class 3 misdemeanor. So without the county assessor's designation of agricultural land, it's just a one class difference in misdemeanor. It does not mean that the trespass itself was insufficient. Thank you for your time.
In answer to your question, Judge Gabriel, there was no evidence whatsoever presented by the prosecution of that element. None. Everybody missed it. So what the court instructed the jury on about agricultural land was absolutely erroneous. The jury couldn't find, based on that, that the element of the offense was met.
Mr. Franco, you say in your brief that we should review this issue for plain error, even though the trial defense attorney submitted an instruction that was rejected by the trial court that tracked the statutory language. What's your basis for saying that the standard of review is plain error?
Well, I'd like to say otherwise, but the fact of the matter is that after having submitted a legally correct instruction, defense counsel said no objection.
Okay, well then,
so that kind of sticks me having to say I think it's a plain error analysis. Well, there's absolutely no proof. This isn't just instructional error. There's absolutely no evidence of any kind, regardless of credible or non-credible, as to this element.
That's what I thought you were going to answer to my question, which leads to my next question, which is, was it invited error then for the defense trial lawyer to agree to the prosecutor's proposed instruction?
No, it was not, because she submitted a legally correct instruction and then didn't object. Had she not submitted a legally correct instruction, it might be invited error. But does invited error apply to a conviction where there is no proof beyond a reasonable doubt of all the elements? No, because that's constitutional error. So that would be, and I just wanted to clarify one thing. There were actually five jurors who responded to defense counsel's questions about bad neighbor episodes rather than three. And I'm sorry that I don't have the numbers before me, but I recall going through the transcripts again and counting five of them. And the last point that I'd like to make with regard to the Batson challenge is that if the court simply got the legal standard for rejecting or sustaining a Batson challenge wrong, then there should be no difference. That's a de novo review because if the judge applied the wrong legal standard, you don't defer.
Ask you, Ms. Hosley said that if we were to overturn the verdict on sufficiency with regard to the misdemeanor two, that we would enter a we would remand with directions to enter a conviction on the misdemeanor three. What's your position on that?
That would be correct if Mrs. Ramirez had offense.
Okay.
Mrs. Ramirez did not have offense, therefore. Actually, under Schaefer, under the Supreme Court trespass case Schaefer, there cannot be a trespass where the premises are not fenced or otherwise, moated. So if Mrs. Ramirez did not have a fence, and by her own admission on cross-examination, she did not have a fence, there couldn't be a trespass, because there's no evidence that she ever told Mr. Lyons not to come on her property.
It would have to be her fence. I mean, if all of her neighbors had fences that fenced her in, that would not be sufficient.
Sure, my neighbor has a fence. I can't go hang a no trespassing sign on his fence. It's not mine.
Before you sit down, Mr. DeFranco, I confess your answer about whether if there was a fence the court could enter the misdemeanor three surprised me a little bit. The answer is the same? I don't think that anybody ever asked, and if you don't find this element, you can enter misdemeanor three. It seems the only thing submitted to the jury was the misdemeanor two.
Right.
So notwithstanding that, your position, assume if there was a fence, that we could remand with instructions to enter the misdemeanor three?
Yes, you could, under both Rodriguez and Cowden. You could. The Supreme Court did in those cases.
Rodriguez in which?
Cowden.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, counsel. The case now stands submitted. An opinion will issue in due course.